Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will bring us our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
American Attorney General Jeff Sessions has canceled a federal policy that let American states legalize marijuana. The move came just days after California, the country's largest state, began permitting recreational use of the drug. President Donald Trump's top law enforcement official announced the change Thursday. Instead of the earlier hands-off policy, Sessions will let federal lawyers in states where marijuana is already legal decide how aggressively to enforce federal law. In a memo, Sessions asked federal lawyers to consider the seriousness of the crime and its impact in deciding which marijuana activities to prosecute under these laws. The move by Sessions is likely to create questions in states where it is legal to buy, use, and grow marijuana. Although some state laws have legalized the use of the drug for medical and recreational reasons, marijuana remains illegal under U.S. federal law. In 2013, the Obama administration announced in a memo that it would not resist states' efforts to legalize marijuana. The memo urged the states to keep marijuana from getting to places where it remained illegal. And it asked the states to keep the drug from criminal gangs and children. Republican lawmaker Cory Gardner of Colorado quickly voiced opposition to Sessions' plan. Colorado is among 8 states that have legalized marijuana for recreational use. Gardner said in a Twitter message that the Justice Department has trampled on the will of the voters in Colorado and other states. He also said the action goes against what Sessions had said he would do before becoming Attorney General. Along with Colorado, recreational use of marijuana is legal in Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, California, Maine, and Massachusetts, and in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Another 21 U.S. states permit the use of marijuana for medical reasons. The legal sale of marijuana has become a multi-million dollar business. It helps fund schools, educational programs, and law enforcement. In California, the business is estimated to bring in $1 billion a year in tax money within the next several years. Maria McFarland Sanchez Moreno is with the Drug Policy Alliance. She called Sessions' policy a return to outdated drug war policies that mainly affected minorities. She added that Sessions wants to maintain a system that has led to tremendous injustice and that has wasted federal resources on a huge scale. I'm Katie Weaver.
A Chinese official says the United States should not blame China for the widespread use of opioid drugs in America. Yu Haibin of the China National Narcotics Control Commission spoke to reporters last week. He said there is little evidence that China provided much of the chemicals used to produce the powerful drug fentanyl. Fentanyl is a synthetic drug similar to morphine that is prescribed by doctors to block pain. Fentanyl is said to be 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine. The U.S. and China have worked together to fight the worldwide flow of illegal man-made drugs. But some issues remain disputed. In November, U.S. President Donald Trump voiced strong concerns about what he called a flood of cheap and deadly fentanyl that is made in China. He said the drug is part of the deadliest drug epidemic in U.S. history. Speaking of recent drug shipments, Yu said, China doesn't deny that shipments to the U.S. happen, but there isn't the proof to show how much, whether it's 20% or 80%. He said U.S. officials have sent him information about only 6 shipments from China in the past year. In October, the Associated Press identified 12 Chinese companies willing to export the drug carfentanil around the world. AP says the cost was a few thousand dollars for 1 kilogram. Carfentanil is said to be 100 times more powerful than fentanyl. It is used as an anesthetic for elephants and other large animals. Yu urged the U.S. to share more information with Chinese officials. He said the overuse of pain medication and cultural attitudes about drugs have increased the demand for opioids in America. As many states decriminalize marijuana, the public's attitudes and trends of thinking toward drugs will also have a bad effect, Yu said. Yu told reporters that China wants to work more closely with U.S. law enforcement and also with officials in Mexico. The drugs are believed to pass through Mexico on their way to the U.S. Chinese officials announced that they raided a factory that makes fentanyl in November. Officials said they seized 4.7 kilograms of the drug. The U.S. Immigration and Customs Agency provided information about an online seller named Diana. It turns out that Diana was an illegal drug organization of 19 people. China has supported a U.S. proposal this year to add substances used to make fentanyl to a United Nations list of controlled substances. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that most fentanyl overdoses come from illegally made versions of the drug. The agency says more than 66,000 people in America died from drug overdoses in the 12-month period ending in May of 2017. That is more than a 17% increase from the year before. I'm Jill Robbins.
English learners have difficulty with gerunds and infinitives. A gerund is the ing form of a verb that functions the same as a noun. For example, running is fun. In this sentence, running is the gerund. It acts just like a noun.
The infinitive form of a verb appears either as the basic form with no marking or with the word to. For example, you can say, I might run to the store, or I like to run. In this sentence, to run is the infinitive.
It is difficult for English learners to know whether to use a gerund or an infinitive after a verb. Here's an example. Which sentence is correct? Sentence 1. I suggested going to dinner. Sentence 2. I suggested to go to dinner. Sentence 1 with the gerund is correct. I suggested going to dinner. Why? You can only use a gerund after the verb suggest.
Let's take the word like. You can say, I like running, or I like to run. Both sentences have the same meaning. You can use either a gerund or an infinitive after like. Now let's try enjoy. We can say, I enjoy running. But we cannot say, I enjoy to run. Why? Only a gerund can follow the verb enjoy.
Are you confused yet? You're not alone. Gerunds and infinitives confuse even very advanced English learners. Basically, some verbs are followed by gerunds, some verbs are followed by infinitives, and some verbs can be followed by gerunds or infinitives. Native speakers do not think about the difference. But English learners have to memorize the hundreds of different verb combinations.
Here are a few tips. Tip number 1. You almost always find a gerund after a preposition. For example, she is afraid of flying. In this sentence, of is the preposition, and flying is the gerund. You cannot say, she is afraid of to fly. An infinitive cannot be the object of a preposition. Only a gerund can. You could say, she is afraid to fly. But in this sentence, the preposition of is gone.
Tip number 2. When you are talking about an activity, you usually use a gerund. For example, I stopped smoking. You can describe many activities by using go before a gerund. Let's go shopping, or we went skiing.
Let's see how much you know. Try to complete these sentences using the verb study. Ready? I'll read the first part of the sentence and you finish it. I enjoy
studying.
I considered
studying.
I managed
to study.
I hope
to study.
I suggested
studying.
I like
studying or to study.
This is only a simple introduction to a complicated grammar topic.
There is no quick and easy way to learn gerunds and infinitives. It takes years of practice and familiarity with the English language. Next time you read or listen to a VOA Learning English story, pay attention to the use of gerunds and infinitives. Over time, you will begin to hear the right verb combination.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The United States declared war on Britain in 1812. It did so because Britain refused to stop seizing American ships that traded with France, Britain's enemy in Europe. Sometimes there were also seizures of American sailors. These seizures were known as impressment. Britain finally suspended its orders against neutral trade after a change in government. But the British acted too late. The United States had already declared war. Today, we continue the story of the War of 1812. Most of Britain's forces were battling the soldiers of Napoleon Bonaparte in Europe. Historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Alan Taylor says that as a result, the British could send only a small force to the United States.
And so the British were basically fighting the war against the United States on the defensive in Canada while trying to raid the American coast, using their advantage in the more powerful Royal Navy.
For its part, the United States was far from ready to fight. The country had not fought a war or needed an army for a long time. There were only 8,000 American soldiers. The soldiers, who were young, knew little about war. And the officers who knew about war were old enough to have led troops in the American Revolution. President James Madison named two top generals, 62-year-old Henry Dearborn and 63-year-old Thomas Pinckney. The United States had only a few warships and gunboats with which to face the British Navy, the most powerful naval force in the world. Historian and professor Alan Taylor says the American people were divided about the war.
A majority of them supported the Madison administration and agreed that they tried the embargo, it had failed, and that something had to be done because national honor, they felt, was at stake, and that they needed to stop the British practice of impressment. And they were also upset about the British military aid to these Indian peoples who were restricting American expansion.
Alan Taylor says, for those reasons, many Americans supported the war, particularly in the southern, western, and mid-Atlantic states.
But in New England, most of the people supported the opposition party, the Federalists, and they were very bitter about the war. They felt that it was really being waged for illegitimate reasons, that diplomacy could have just papered over the disagreement over impressment. And so they did their best to obstruct the war effort. They not only didn't want to contribute to the war effort, but they wanted to block it as best they could.
Church bells were rung and flags were lowered in New England when the declaration of war was announced. There was also the problem of getting enough men to serve as soldiers. Congress had approved an increase of 25,000 men. Only 5,000 agreed to serve. Members of Congress from the western states had spoken proudly of how their people would rush to fight the British. This did not happen. The first request to Kentucky for soldiers produced only 400 men. Historian Alan Taylor says that some states in the Northeast did not offer any soldiers at all, especially for invasions into Canada.
And even when the governors would cooperate, as did for example, the governor of New York, the militia would often march to the border and then decide that their constitutional duty was only to defend their state and not to help the United States invade another country. And so they'd go on a sit-down strike once they got to the border.
Nevertheless, an American general named William Hull led 2,000 men across the Canadian border. But the British general there was prepared, and the attack failed. Although Hull had the stronger force and plenty of supplies, he retreated to Detroit. He was chased by a smaller force of British soldiers and Indians. After the war, Hull was tried by a military court on charges of cowardice. The court found him guilty and ordered him shot. But President Madison, because of Hull's service during the Revolutionary War, permitted the old soldier to live. The next American attack was made from Fort Niagara, a military post in New York on the shore of Lake Ontario. A small group of American soldiers crossed the Niagara River and attacked the British. But some Americans from New York refused to cross the border to help against the British. They calmly watched as British soldiers shot down the attacking Americans. The third campaign was made by General Henry Dearborn. He led a state militia force from Plattsburgh, New York, to the Canadian border. He was planning to cross the border and attack Montreal. But again, the soldiers refused to cross the border. Dearborn could do nothing but march them back to Plattsburgh. British forces at this time were winning victories. They captured an American fort in northern Michigan, and Indians fighting for the British captured a fort at the place now known as Chicago. Instead of marching through Canada without difficulty, the Americans found themselves trying hard to keep the British out of the state of Ohio. For a while, the small American Navy was doing better than the Army. Just 2 months after the war started, the United States warship Constitution forced a British ship to surrender. Several months later, another American ship, the Wasp, captured the British ship Frolic. Then a frigate named the United States defeated one of Britain's most famous fighting ships, the Macedonian. The British ship was captured and brought to the United States. There were other victories at sea. At the end of 6 months, the United States Navy had captured 6 British ships and lost only one of its own vessels. Private American trade ships had been armed with guns when the war started. They, too, were successful against the British. They captured more than 300 British trade ships. But the American successes forced Britain to bring more of its fighting ships into the war with the United States. By the middle of 1813, a year after the war started, British ships controlled the East Coast. No American ship could enter or leave any port south of New England. Meanwhile, the military situation was improving for the Americans in what was then the West. William Henry Harrison, governor of the Indiana Territory, formed a large force to try to capture Detroit from the British. At the same time, Captain Oliver Perry built 5 warships on Lake Erie. With these, and 4 he already had, Perry met and defeated a British naval force. Perry reported his victory to Harrison. "We have met the enemy, and they are ours." Perry's victory and Harrison's large force caused the British to withdraw from Detroit and from a British fort at Malden in Canada. Harrison's men continued to chase the enemy. They caught them and defeated them in the Battle of the Tens. Killed in this battle was the great Indian chief Tecumseh, who had been fighting for the British. American forces made new attempts to win control of Lake Ontario and invade Canada across the Niagara River. But none of these succeeded. Late in 1813, British soldiers crossed the river and captured Fort Niagara. They also burned the town of Buffalo. By April 1814, Napoleon was forced from power in Europe, and the war between France and Britain was over. The end of the war in Europe permitted Britain to send many of its soldiers to fight against the United States. About 4,000 British soldiers landed on the Chesapeake coast, southeast of Washington. They met American forces inland at Bladensburg, a town 10 kilometers from Washington. The British soldiers broke through the American lines, and the Americans began to run away. But a group of sailors refused to retreat with their artillery. Commanded by Joshua Barney, the 400 sailors chose to stand and fight. The struggle did not last long against the 4,000 British soldiers. Barney held his position for a half hour before enemy soldiers got behind his men and silenced their guns. Barney was wounded seriously. The British thought so much of his courage that they carried him to a hospital for their own soldiers at Bladensburg. Barney himself said the British officers treated him as a brother. Once the British troops had smashed through Barney's Navy men, nothing stood between them and Washington. The commanders of the British force, General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn, took a group of men to the Capitol building and set fire to it. Then the two commanders went to the White House with the same intention. Before setting fire to the president's home, Cockburn took one of Madison's hats and the seat from one of Dolly Madison's chairs. The admiral found the president's table set for dinner. As a joke, he took a glass of wine and toasted the health of President Jemmy. President Madison had fled the White House. He crossed the Potomac River and started toward his home in Virginia. He joined his wife on the road the second day. They decided to wait about 25 kilometers from Washington. When President Madison returned to the Capitol 3 days later, the British had withdrawn. They had also burned most public buildings.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.